Acuna's hit 12 homers, 24 RBIs, and 25 runs scored leading off. And he got smoked on the very first pitch. Chad Fairchild, right out in front of the plate. Acuna tosses the helmet down, and now in a crouch on the third base line. The very first pitch of the game nails Ronald Acuna Jr., and now the Braves are coming out of their dugout looking at Urania. And now both benches are going to empty.
Brad Snitker's leading the charge.
I don't blame Snip for being mad right here. And I'll tell you what, if the umpire, Chad Fairchild, he should be tossed right here, Joe.
Absolutely, he should.
That's how the Braves game started off last night. First pitch, at least with their at-bat in the bottom half of the first. And that's how our show is going to start out. Good Thursday morning to you. Welcome into Darren and Donick here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Darren McFarland, that is me, Willie Donick. And he's saying good morning. Willie Donick,
good
take two.
Good morning.
Take three. Action. And that's him. We are actually in studio today. We are in our Wholesale Link Game Studios because out at Titans camp, it looks like weather is going to be bad here. Maybe in the next hour or so. Didn't really want to risk it. It did not look good coming in from the west. So we decided to pull up and morning drive was out there, and it looks like it's going to be a little bit later. Still heavy, heavy football discussions today. Everything that we would be doing out there will continue. We'll just be, unfortunately, in studio. So we will talk to Titans GM John Robinson when they are done with practice today with the Bucks. We'll get another Bucks flavor like we did yesterday with Rick Stroud beginning at 10:15. We'll also talk to Derrick Henry in the third hour. Tim Hasselbeck will join us. Couldn't do it yesterday, was a part of their fantasy football marathon on ESPN, so he'll join us at 11 o'clock today. So
has he recovered?
Well, we're going to find out. A lot of football today, but we're going to start with what happened last night. And I'm just going to be perfectly honest. Chase McAbabe from our staff texted me and said, did you see what happened in the Braves game in the bottom of the first? I wasn't watching. I mean, I know that a lot of people say, what? You weren't watching the Braves and the Marlins? No, I wasn't. I told Chase, because he told me what happened. I said, I'm just going to be perfectly honest. I really only care about the Smyrna Braves. That's really the only Braves team that I care about, and I certainly don't care about the Marlins. They don't care about them in Miami, so I don't care about them. But obviously this whole thing's gone viral, and I did watch it over and over and over again and read all the accounts because it became the story last night. And I got to be honest, Willie, this is one of the things that I really, really hate about baseball. I just do. I've never liked it. I've never understood it. I don't like it in sports, period. I don't like it in hockey. I know I've had these discussions in postgame with Hal Gill. And back in the day when the game was a little bit different, when he played for a long time in the NHL, you know, when games got out of hand, which we've seen with the Predators, right? Last year, didn't they beat the Sharks 7-1? I mean, games get out of hand in the NHL sometimes. You play 82 games. Sometimes teams are going to get smoked. And the mentality of when you're getting smoked, just to take out all your aggression and your anger on the team because they're beating your brains in, it's just stupid. I cringe when I hear those stories of how players have to then start reacting differently whenever they're beating up on a team because they know what's about to come. And I hate that about hockey. As much as I love the sport, I hate that whole mentality. Look, if you're getting your brains beat in, get better. Sorry that you weren't on that night. Sorry it was their night. Take it out on somebody else or take it out on them the next time you see them. But there's no reason to do that night. It's not their fault. They're better than you on that night. It's your fault that you didn't show up or they did. Either way, it's the same thing in baseball. I mean, baseball needs good stories. It does. Acuna Jr. has been a really good story. 5 home runs in 5 straight games, 8 homers in 8 games. Baseball needs storylines, especially as training camps are beginning in the NFL. College football season is just around the corner. This is where baseball struggles to keep everybody's attention. And here you have this young, young star. Looks like the future is extremely bright in Atlanta for him. And just Urena just decided, you know, it sounds to me, if you listen to what everybody said after the game, this guy just went rogue. Now, I realize he plunks batters all the time. I think he was tied for the lead in the National League this year. I think he led everybody last year, or was tied with the most plunked batters last year. So the guy has been known to hit batters. I get it. But this was not about him throwing inside. He is proclaiming innocence, acting like he just wanted to throw. He was throwing inside. Give me a break. He was on a mission to do this. And it's just senseless. What if Acuña Jr. is lost for a good while? I just think this should not be tolerated in baseball. I just think they need to get this nonsense out of the game. People paid money to go see that young man play last night. They were there because of him, and he took him out in the first inning. Well, he tried to come back, but he left in the top of the second. He took him out of the game, and what if he's hurt for an extended period of time? It just, to me, because why? Because he's been red hot? Because he's been homering off your team? Well, if you don't like it, here's an idea. Get him out or walk him, but don't plunk him. Plunk him because of what? Has he been showing you up? I don't know. I guess if you view him hitting home runs off of you, your team as showing you up, okay, I guess if you view it that way, but that's kind of his job as a batter, you know, to get hits or hit home runs or to show up the opposition. It's your job to get him out.
I agree. I mean, pretty obvious. I would say it's not a baseball problem. It's a Urania problem. It doesn't happen. Can you recall any brawls this year? There's not as many as there were years ago, I don't think.
I'm surprised this wasn't a brawl. I mean, the bench is
cleared
twice.
Because what they've done, they've changed the rules. The bench is only cleared once.
Well, I thought there was a round two, no?
No round two.
Maybe Snicker had a round two.
Well, it was extended after he got hit with the pitch, and there was a long discussion after that. Because they've changed the rules, I think there was a time where before they put the rules in the way they did, that there would be retaliation without a doubt. There would have been retaliation and another mound charging and another bench clearing brawl. But now, because they correctly, and it was delayed, I don't know if they were going to do it right away, but they threw Urania out, and then they issued a warning to both sides. If anybody else got plunked, that guy would have been thrown out right away. And the Braves showed great restraint. Now, the next time the two teams play, I wouldn't be surprised if there is a retaliation of some sort. That's when it will happen. The only thing I don't know is, because I've been paying attention to the Braves, I haven't watched every inning to know if, because I certainly haven't noticed it, on this tear that Acuña's on, did he do anything to show up the opposition? Other than just
I've heard
absolutely
nothing.
Rip.
I mean, Jose Bautista, you know, you knew people were mad about the bat flip, which you know how I feel. Who cares? I've never had a problem with the bat flip.
But that's what
but
upsets other team.
I haven't heard anything about Acuña. I haven't heard anybody say that, you know, his trot is too slow. I've heard nothing of that. Now, this is the other part that really bothers me. Well, we've laughed at his Twitter account, and I know he's one of you, Mets broadcaster Keith Hernandez, but his comments about the incident just had me shaking my head.
In today's game, they don't throw with hitters. I don't think the hitters know. So they don't know how to get out of the way of a ball or know it's coming. And when you hit three home runs, I'm sorry. You got to go down. You're going to lean over the plate? You're going to let them put a whooping on you? It's not going to happen. But I know it happens in today's game. And obviously, you've got the Marlins. I'm sure Don Mattingly ordered that. I don't think the pitcher out there did. Not today's pitchers. There was a day when you didn't have to tell a pitcher. If he was getting his fanny kicked, he would knock someone down. They're playing the Cardinals, excuse me. So you got two teams fighting for a division and fighting for a wild card.
Right, they're playing the Marlins.
They're playing the Marlins. I'm sorry. So you got I got messed up there. So you've got
a team that's out of it that's retaliating again. And that's just part of the baseball code. Code, if someone's hitting home runs, they're leaning all over that plate. I'm sorry. I'm not going to let you do that. Here's one in your ribs or on your back, and let's see if you stay in there the next time. And that's just my strong feeling. I'm sorry.
Well, it's a fine line. First of all, Keith is bored. The Mets were winning the game against the Orioles by a wide 15? Margin, and they're going nowhere.
That's like a month's worth of runs for the Mets.
And I don't completely disagree with Keith Hernandez's notion that a pitcher has to try to pitch inside. That it's the fine line. But to come right out and throw it on the first pitch of the game, 97 miles an hour, is bad. Also, the Marlins don't look good. If it had been the second time through the order or even later in the same at-bat, I don't think it would have caused as much of a stir. But to come right out and do it on the first pitch is a little too obvious. And also, because it hit him on the elbow and eventually had him get pulled from the game, it really looks bad. If he had hit him right in the rear end or even in the ribs, that's not as big of a deal. So it is a fine line.
I don't view it that way.
I mean, a pitcher has to be able to pitch inside.
I understand. You have to establish pitchers can pitch inside. But he was not pitching inside. He was hitting Acuña.
No, he threw at him.
Okay, he wasn't pitching inside. That's a different story. He was hitting him. Pitchers are allowed to pitch inside. Okay, you can legitimately pitch inside. But he wasn't pitching inside. He was out to hit him.
And Keith Hernandez is from the old school where he thinks that's fair game. To a degree. Now, throwing at somebody's head is a different thing. Now, he didn't throw it at his head. He hit him in the elbow. It would have been a different thing if he'd thrown it right at his head.
Titans are practicing against the Bucks again today, and then they'll meet Saturday night under the lights at Nissan Stadium. We're going to learn a little bit more about this team that's in town. We'll talk to somebody from Tampa next on 102.5 The Game. Becker on Darren Adonik on this Thursday morning. ESPN 102.5 The Game. Titans and Bucks, final day of practice together. They'll be under the lights Saturday night at Nissan Stadium. Preseason game number two, first home game for the Titans. And learn a little bit more about the team they've been practicing with yesterday and again today. We are in studio today. Could be some weather pending coming up over at Titans training camp. Trevor Sikkema. Pewter Report, he covers the Bucks for them. Trevor, how you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you guys? Thanks for having me.
Well, we've been out there for many, many years, 20 to be exact, and we've endured some serious storms over the years, and we decided not to try to get blown away, and if indeed they come in, I think we decided just to go on and do it in studio. So hopefully everything is all right. Are they still on the field practicing?
They are. It hasn't started raining yet, but I can be your weather channel's Jim Cantore today for the severe weather if I need to be on the scene for you guys.
So no tempers yesterday. Both coaches have said, hey, no fighting. It's not going to be tolerated. What did you see through your eyes yesterday in practice between the Titans and the Bucks?
Yeah, no fighting, but plenty of jawing, and I think the trash talk kind of started from the Buccaneers. They've got some fiery players. The first one is linebacker Quan Alexander. He's an extremely passionate guy. When he makes a play on you, he will absolutely let you know about it. He did that a couple times. They had him going up through A-gap blitzes, getting a couple of sacks yesterday. I thought the Buccaneers overall really had the Titans' number yesterday, I think mainly across the board. And Alexander was kind of poking at him from the trash talk perspective, getting in their heads a little bit. Jason Pierre-Paul was doing that. The new defensive end that they have as well. So tensions, you know, the respect is certainly there between these teams. We're seeing a lot of high fives, a lot of head taps, everything like that. These are two talented rosters. But there's definitely some tensions here. So I'm interested to see kind of how it goes, how the competition elevates again with these two going up against each other today.
You know, unfortunately, kickers, they're rarely talked about. It's kind of like the officials, right, or the refs. The only time you're usually talking about them is when something bad is happening. Rarely are you going, man, that officiating crew, job well done. That
Correct.
Kicker, job well done. Usually you're only talking about a kicker whenever it's bad. We actually went out to Los Angeles yesterday and got a Chargers preview, and certainly they had kicking woes early on in the season that cost them games and probably cost them the playoffs last year. Tampa had tried to address their kicking issues with a high pick, which was rare in the NFL, and it didn't work out, as you well know. Have their kicking woes, is it better? I noticed already some misses in the first preseason game.
It is better, I will say that. Last year was about as dumpster fire as you can have for a position that, like you just said, supposed to be an easy solve. Roberto Aguayo, that high draft pick, was not the guy. Even the guy they brought in, Nick Folk, they tried to bring in a veteran behind him to say, okay, well, at the very least, we'll have this guy on our roster and he'll get it done. Guess what? He didn't get it done. So here they are again this year, another new kicker, Chandler Catanzaro. He's been kind of all around the NFL. He played for the Cardinals, played for the Jets. But he's solid. He's a guy who's pretty solid. He's got solid stats. He's had a great training camp up until the first game, but then that first kick in-game in a Buccaneer uniform was actually an extra point, and he pushed it. Ooh. So he missed another field goal after that, but had two extra points, two field goals. He even made the game-winning field goal after that. So they're hoping that was just kind of jitters. But obviously, anytime you talk about kicking in the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, it's a little bit of a, I don't know, some voodoo, some curse, some magic, whatever you want, kind of going against them. It's kind of creeping in the back of your head a little bit.
What are the expectations in Tampa for this team? Because that's a tricky division. We see it seems like it's a revolving door. It's like every year there's somebody new winning that division and usually making a deep run in the playoffs. They have a big, big year. Well, what are the expectations here? I mean, this is a Titans team that went to the second round of the playoffs, and they still cleaned house with their coaching staff, and so expectations are high. What are they down in Tampa?
Yeah, it's really interesting, depending on who you ask, because the Buccaneers, with Hard Knocks last year and how much they were on Good Morning Football because of that, they were almost kind of like the media darling, that sleeper team around the league. It was like, hey, you know, watch out for the Buccaneers. They've made some nice draft picks. They've made some splashy free agency. People picked them even to be a playoff team last year, and it all fell flat on their face. And the thing is that if you look at the Bucs team last year on paper and you look at the Bucs team this year on paper, this year's team is way better. So you've got to think that if that's the main component in your head, you've got to think that if you thought playoffs last year and it was just a down year, playoffs have got to be in the conversation for this team because of how much they've invested in them. But then you look at their schedule. It's one of the hardest schedules in the entire NFL with the division that they play in, like you just said. Then they have, you know, they're hosting the Super Bowl champs. They're hosting the Steelers on Monday night. They're also playing the Cowboys and the Ravens. And so the schedule is doing them no favors. But when you look at this team, the roster that they have, this is a roster that's got to be able to compete for a playoff spot and get in eventually. And so it's a tricky evaluation of what you think they're going to be this year because of how it looks on paper and how it kind of fell flat on their face last year.
We were doing the inevitable comparisons yesterday for Jameis Winston and Marcus Mariota. And one thing we pointed out, just looking at Jameis's stats when he's been in there, the Bucs have thrown the ball a lot. They have leaned on him a lot, and they have not had a great balance in the running game. Is that something they would like to see more of this year, even though they've really got some nice weapons for him to throw to? Would they like to run a little bit more this year?
I think they would like to have more efficiency running the ball. I think that Dirk Koetter likes having a passing attack that can stretch you vertically or horizontally. I think passing is always going to be the main component of this team. When you look at a guy like Jameis Winston being the franchise quarterback there, he's still the number one even when he comes back from his suspension. And just knowing what Dirk Koetter likes to do on offense, I think it's going to remain mainly a passing offense. But he does talk about balance, and I think they just need more efficiency. I mean, Doug Martin was not efficient last year. Charles Sims, not efficient. Jacquizz Rodgers, barely efficient. And then Peyton Barber at the end of the year was the only guy who got him even near 4 yards per carry. He was even a little bit under that, but he was the only guy who got him near that. They've got to be able to have a running game that gets them much closer and a little bit over that 4 yards per carry average. They've just got to be more efficient in what they do. I'm not sure it's going to come with more volume, more carries. They've just got to find a way to do it better and put the running game in better spots throughout the game.
We focused probably more of our show yesterday on the Titans offense against the Bucs defense, but those that observed the other half of the field where the Bucs offense was going to work against the Titans defense, they really had a lot of praise about Tampa Bay's wide receivers and receivers in general. They thought they probably had the upper hand on the Titans secondary, which is considered a strength of the Titans team. And I want to ask you in particular about DeSean Jackson. Floyd Reese from our staff singled him out yesterday This is obviously a guy that has done a lot in the league, but he's getting up there in age. What do you expect from him this year?
It's kind of like the running game. It's a little bit of the same answer. They've got to figure out a way to use DeSean Jackson better, because Tampa has never been known for having an electric offense, really, at any point in their franchise history. So getting a guy like DeSean Jackson in here last year, you know, the eyes were wide of what could be and the possibilities. You know, they envisioned those 50, 60-yard passes down the field. But the thing with DeSean Jackson is everybody knows him like that, the defense included. And so the defense was keying in on DeSean getting far down the field. Jameis had some accuracy issues last year, couldn't end up connecting with him on a lot of those deep passes, even when he was open. And so I think it's a lot like the running game. They've just got to find a way to use DeSean better. And we saw this a little bit yesterday when he was going up against the Titans cornerback Malcolm Butler. DeSean was cooking him a little bit just with short area speed. It doesn't have to be 40, 50 yards down the field. DeSean can do that, but he doesn't have to do it every time. He can win in other ways, and I think the Bucs have just got to get a little bit better at having DeSean, putting him in places to win with speed in areas that aren't necessarily go routes all the way down the field. You can use him plenty in different areas, and so I think that DeSean could still, of course, have a very productive year. They've just got to put him in better places to succeed.
All right, let's go fantasy focus here. O.J. Howard is the tight end. We know how talented he is. We've watched him play a lot, and he certainly had some pretty good numbers when you get down to it. Is he poised maybe to take another step forward this year?
I'll tell you, I was on a fantasy show about 2.5 weeks ago, and they asked me, hey, you take O.J. Howard or you take Cameron Bray? Which one? How similar are their stats going to be? And I actually told them, I'd still pick Cameron Bray. In 2 weeks, I have seen O.J. Howard be put into the first team and almost explode in any chance he can in practice. And so since that time, I'm all in on O.J. Howard having a breakout second year. This guy's going to get all kinds of looks. Cameron Braid is still going to be involved in the offense, which might be a little annoying for fantasy owners that have him that have Howard as a tight end. But he is going to get plenty of looks. He's going to get plenty of shots at the end zone. O.J. Howard, we've heard this from the coaching staff too. They think the sky is the limit with this guy, and I think that they're going to raise his ceiling and his potential a lot higher this year because he's going to be even more emphasized in the passing game in 2018.
That's exactly what we're looking for, Trevor. Thank you. Good stuff. Hey, wish we could have done this in person, but if it does, head over there to St. Thomas Sports Park, head for shelter, because we've seen it get bad over there.
No, guys, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for doing this. Trevor Sikkema covers the Bucks for the Pewter Report. That's where you can find his work. We'll come back with Richard Deitch from The Athletic. That's next on Darren and Donick, 102.5 The Game. Looking out on the morning rain, I used to feel so uninspired. You'll probably get a lot of Aretha today on the show.
And everywhere.
Yeah.
And it should be that way.
Yep. Sad news.
Sad news.
She has left us at age 76. We kind of knew things had gone downhill over the weekend.
Yeah.
And
we braced ourselves a bit, but
yep.
Boy, you go down that library, you can keep going for a long time.
No doubt about it. Richard Deitch from The Athletic is on the line with us. Tim Hasselbeck coming up at 11 o'clock. Richard, how you doing?
I'm good.
How are things up in Toronto?
Sunny. Humid. But it tastes like freedom, to be very honest.
It tastes like freedom. Hard Knocks. I'm a huge fan on this show. No, I don't. Look, I don't. I come right out and just say it. I look forward to it every year. I don't care who the subject is. It looks like the Browns have captured some folks' attention. Got pretty good ratings on it. Are you a Hard Knocks guy? I know you've put some stuff out there on The Athletic about it.
Yeah, you know, I didn't actually watch the second episode. I did watch the first one. But I am a Hard Knocks fan because I have really immense respect for NFL Films and the crew that works Hard Knocks every year. A couple of years ago, for when I was at Sports Illustrated, I went to Cincinnati and watched them for a couple of days filming Hard Knocks, and you really just come away with just how unbelievably talented the camera people are, the operators are, the editors are. So, I mean, it's really superb, high-quality filmmaking. And this year, I have to give the Browns a lot of credit. You know, the way it works is that the teams see a cut before it ever gets to us, and they have certainly the right of refusal to take anything out that they think would be, you know, would give other teams a competitive advantage, stuff that they don't want in. But, historically they've been pretty good about letting some stuff in that you might not think would get in. And I have to give the Browns credit. The Todd Haley stuff from the first episode, where he's really questioning Hugh Jackson, kind of questioning the entire culture of the Browns, really. I was impressed that they left that in, because that Hugh Jackson was really criticized for that after the fact. I read a lot of columns basically calling him out for that, and I thought that was pretty ballsy of him to let that in, probably knowing, well, if he didn't know he was going to be criticized, that's one thing, but if he did know, totally bullying on him, because it gave you a real interesting insight into what those coaches' meetings are like and how there's different philosophies. And then, there's always every year going to be people who stand out, who sort of become stars of their own right. I think some of that is real. I think some of that is honestly a little acting for the cameras. Rex Ryan famously when Hard Knocks with the Jets. And, I think Jarvis Landry absolutely is a really interesting big personality. But, again, you always wonder, if they're amping it up a little bit for the cameras. But overall, I think it's a great production, and it's definitely one of the best sports documentary series that we've ever had.
Yeah, any young player should watch episode 2 and know what not to do, what not to say to your head coach, because it may get you traded. Like, say to him, well, if you don't want me, trade me, like Coleman did. You'll find that out in episode 2.
Yeah.
Barging into Hugh Jackson's office. Yeah, if you don't want me, just trade me. Okay, we will.
Yeah, and again, that's interesting that they left that in. First episode, by the way, did really well. 7.5 million viewers was, I think, the second most watched first episode since 2015. Maybe the second most watched episode since 2010. Maybe I'm right about that. And then last night's, whenever it was, Tuesday's episode dropped a little bit to 5 million. But that's not so unexpected, because usually the debut episode is always much higher. But I think Hard Knocks has a good story. They're counterintuitively, you might think an 0-16 team is not interesting, but I think actually they're really, really interesting, and more interesting than like a 7-9 team.
It doesn't seem like ESPN right now is ready to completely move away from Chris Berman. It seems like they're in talks of maybe trying to woo him back.
Yeah, I heard this too. I heard this like a couple weeks ago, and I couldn't nail it down, so I didn't want to publish anything, even on spec. So credit Andrew Marchand of the New York Post for getting it out there and feeling like he's got enough to publish. I definitely think it's true. I just heard this a couple weeks ago that Norby Williamson is an executive there who's now in charge of SportsCenter, and he has a long relationship with Chris Berman. He was Chris Berman's PA way, way back in the day, like 30-something years ago. He's got a long-term relationship with him. He's also an executive who's tried to retool SportsCenter kind of back to the 90s and 2000s, where it's just very highlight-driven. Whether that turns out to be a good strategy or not, we'll see. So, yeah, I think probably there's something to that. Wouldn't be surprised if you see Berman have some kind of Sunday night after the games roll on SportsCenter where, maybe they give him some 10, 20-minute segment, 15-minute segment where he does the highlights of all the games. I don't expect him to be back on Sunday NFL Countdown. I think that has passed. You're not going to see him hosting with Randy Moss, Woodson, or whoever's there. But I would not be surprised at all if he has some kind of extended Sports Center segment during the NFL season.
We're talking to Richard Deitz, the media circus, now with The Athletic. And Richard, you wrote a good piece. And it's funny, we were talking about this very thing on Monday. We had a guest on, Taylor Zarzur, who was hosting the Sirius satellite radio coverage, about the dynamic of when Tiger is really doing well, but you have a tremendous story in Brooks Koepka winning the tournament and trying to meld those and balance those two things together as they're happening. But put it all together, CBS certainly hit a home run with the ratings.
Yeah, I mean, Tiger is the one who drives the ratings. There's no Brooks Koepka. But, no one is tuning in who has not watched golf before to watch Brooks Koepka win a major. It's all related to Tiger. And those ratings were up 70%, which is, almost unheard of in sports television viewership. They drew basically 9 million viewers for the final round of the PGA Championship, which is a pretty incredible number. And, yeah, I talked to CBS's lead golf producer, a guy named Lance Barrow, who's basically been doing that for 20-something years. And it's, you know, it's a tricky navigation. You know that Tiger's a big story. You know that people want to watch Tiger. At the same time, these guys cover the golf tour every week. So they have to, they can't abandon in full, the Adam Scotts of the world, the Brooks Koepkes. So I went back and looked. I thought they did a pretty good job of really focusing on Tiger, especially at 18, and then still giving us Adam Scott and Brooks Koepka live at 17 and staying in that tournament. But, in my opinion, the people who complain to CBS about too much Tiger, CBS cannot that you can't take that seriously, but you honestly have to just sort of like read it and then just move on, because the reality is Tiger Woods is one of the most fascinating athletes of the last 20 years. The singular and sole reason you just doubled your audience basically is because of him. So to me, you can't overcover him enough. So yeah, I get it. There's some diehards who are like, why do you keep showing Tiger? Why do you do this? Well, you're showing Tiger Woods because he's one of the great athletes of the 21st century, and he had like one of the biggest self-inflicted meltdowns we've ever seen of an athlete of that greatness. And so his story is compelling. And again, I don't feel sorry for Tiger. Most of that's self-inflicted. But it's a fascinating story. It's a total narrative that I think all of us are interested in. So I thought CBS did an excellent job at the PGA, but on the larger scale, honestly, I don't think you can cover Tiger enough at this point in his career, given we're only 2 years removed from people thinking he would never be playing again.
Richard, we have another example of the investigative journalism leading to action on a story in the case of the Maryland situation. Your thoughts on the piece that ESPN did, and maybe how it's contributed to the reaction of Maryland?
To be honest with you, I don't think anything is happening in Maryland without that piece. You could draw the direct line from that piece that ESPN published to President Wallace Lowe, AD Damon Evans, basically calling that news conference and letting you know they went down to talk to that the deceased player's parents and apologizing and accepting, whatever that means, moral and actual responsibility. None of that happens, in my opinion, without ESPN's piece. They had to react. That's what happens when a national place publishes that. Alums read it. They get pissed off, and they start sending letters or emails to the university. The big question is whether, you were impressed by the president being transparent or more transparent than other presidents and getting out there, or, and this is fair too, and this is what I heard from a lot of Maryland types, you're angry still at the fact that it took him, the ESPN piece, to react and to sort of move, because the press ultimately held them accountable. But, yeah, I don't think anything happens at Maryland, at least not in this time frame, without that ESPN piece.
I find it interesting, too, that the trainer, the athletic trainer, that looked like it was pretty clear-cut, the documentation of how they actually treated the athlete when he was under duress. I think what would be more interesting, and maybe where the article shed light where they probably were not willing to go, is how the culture might have fit into how they ended up treating the athlete. That's the more difficult question to ask, I think.
Yeah, great question, and a big legal question. I mean, again, if you take the article at face, and it doesn't seem to me that a lot of people have challenged much of the reporting on the toxic environment at Maryland, it would lead one to believe that the culture there was like, the old Junction Boys, basically, like, putting these guys out there, getting them to practice until, they're basically exhausted or throwing up. I have to be honest with you. I know I'm saying this on a, Nashville, Tennessee radio station where college football is king, but the whole thing just is like, college football, for all its greatness, has so much cesspool stuff and so much BS like tied into it about like manhood and testosterone, and it's, and honestly, it's coaches with power run amok. And in this case, what it looks like, or what it appears to be, is a program pushing this nonsense to the point where a kid died. Like, you just, whatever safeguard you had in place, it just totally were not there in lieu of, you know, trying to get these guys to sort of go to what looked like unhealthy places. So I think it's very clear that Maryland's going to be paying a ton of money to the parents of that kid. Not that it makes up at all for the death of the kid. And I would be stunned if DJ Durkin is coaching at Maryland ever again. And then the question is going to be, should the AD be there? To me, you know, if it falls under your watch, you're responsible. And then, you know, it gets to the larger question of what are the president's responsibility. But, and you guys know this, you know, in the end, there's no satisfaction even if those people resign or are fired. Like, is there any satisfaction from anybody at Michigan State, you know, maybe outside of Larry Nassar going to prison, like losing their job? None. Like, the abuse happened or the death happened. And so it's, we're seeing too many of these stories in college football, and I'm not saying Urban Meyer is a parallel exactly to this, but, you know, from Art Briles to everything else, it's money has just so corrupted this system that I think you're going to see more of this stuff than less, because there's so much money for these universities to make through their athletic departments that they're going to bring guys in who, you know, will be bullies and will do anything basically to get wins. The irony, of course, is that Maryland wasn't even a very good football team.
Yeah. Well said. Here to report that tomorrow, I believe, is when it'll be made official. The Athletic will be in Nashville, but we're gonna hold off. We know who's involved. There'll be some
the pieces are in place.
The pieces are in place, and I think the announcement is going to get made tomorrow. So Athletic will be.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. I made a pledge to my bosses that I would, you know, I'm not reporting on the Athletic in the same way I don't report on Sports Illustrated. I could be criticized for them. That's fine. I have to accept that criticism. But I will say this. Perhaps you guys have excellent sourcing, would be what I might say on that.
Well, we're not going to – I know Will Muschamp says we're gutless, but we're going to leave our sources anonymous, okay? Will
right,
Muschamp, yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, and by the way, how good did Will look over the next couple of days?
You mean the back pedal? He was I timed his back pedal. It was pretty fast. He could probably still play football.
Usain Bolt-esque. But, like, that to me is part and parcel of the tribalism, the worst of the tribalism of college football, where this guy's first instinct is to sort of go off on the press, protect DJ Durkin, and to criticize anonymous sources. Now, whether Will knew this or not, knowing full well, how hard is it to go against a football program like by putting your name on it? There's a reason why you have to give people anonymity and protection. Because look what's happened to Courtney Smith at Ohio State, you know? And
yes.
Again, that's not a perfect – I'm not saying, like, everything she has said is 100% accurate, et cetera, et cetera. But the point is, when you put your name out there like that, you get death threats, you get abuse, you get social media destruction. So this is why anonymity has to be given sometimes to protect sources, particularly people who are still on the staffs of these colleges where – they're still getting paid and their livelihoods exist. And Will Muschamp knows all that, but yet went de facto into protect my coaching buddy at all costs. And it's just a larger problem. And then, again, not surprising but frustrating, you have people in that community then yelling at the press for asking the question as opposed to being upset by Will Muschamp's defend DJ Durkin at all costs stance, which is it's just frustrating.
Yep. I'm not going to go on that rant again. I've already done it this week. Richard, always a pleasure. Thanks for doing this. Have a great weekend, and we'll do it again next week.
You got it. See you guys.
Richard Deitch from The Athletic. Good stuff as always. Back to wrap up the first hour next. I always think of a movie when I hear this song. Wasn't this My Best Friend's Wedding? Is that right?
Good question. I haven't seen that one. I have not seen My Best Friend's Wedding.
I think that's the movie I'm thinking of.
I would have to guess that Aretha Franklin's songs have to be in how many movies? 100 movies?
Oh. A lot.
I mean, a ton. The Big Chill. I mean, you just go right down the list.
You were telling me a story during the break.
Well, Richard mentioned it, referenced it in light of the Maryland situation. Meanwhile, nationally, things have sort of quieted down on what's the latest with Urban Meyer in Ohio State as the committee continues to do their investigation. And how many days left? Remember they said it was going to be 12 days.
Yeah.
This weekend is
I would say
the
by
target.
Monday, I think.
Is that the 12 days or 14 days that they laid out?
Yeah.
Apparently locally, as Richard alluded to, but didn't really go into detail of, the character assassination or the criticism at Courtney Smith is sort of what's going on behind the scenes. So we heard her side of the story. Now you have a lot of people coming out who know her in some way or another. Some defend her, but there are a lot of people that are taking the shots at her. So that I don't know what's going to come out of it, but it is interesting. And you just wonder,
hardcore fan base? Is this what you're talking about?
I do think the hardcore fan base
who's
wants
taking the
to
shots?
Believe. I don't really know. I think, and Julian can help me out on this, but I believe even her mother,
yeah, her
I guess,
own family.
Her own family. Some cousins, her mother, I think.
Yeah, her mother.
Have sort of cast some things on her character that don't make her look as credible.
Her mother, Courtney Smith and her mother apparently estranged.
Yeah.
And Courtney Smith's ex-mother-in-law, Zach Smith, mom, of course, has also come out and said that. Obviously, protecting her son, came out and said that Courtney is lying. And Courtney Smith's own mother is saying that a lot of these things are fabricated, which is appalling that someone's family member, particularly their mother, she's like, I love Courtney, even though her ex-husband, Zach Smith, beat the hell out of her. I love her, but I don't believe what she's saying, which is very interesting how that's working out. So, yeah, not only is the crazy Ohio State fan base that is questioning her character, but also her own family, which I guess makes you go, But still, I don't know how, given what we've seen from and heard from Zach Smith, that we would believe his side.
Well, especially the text messages.
Yeah, the text messages, the photos, it's pretty hard to believe him. And I remember on that Friday when he came out, they had the whole PR storm, him and Urban Meyer. Urban had the statement, basically throwing Gene Smith under the bus, saying he's always done the right things. Okay. And then Zach Smith going on Columbus Sports Radio and saying that Urban didn't know. Within 10 minutes later, going on SportsCenter in a different interview and saying that Urban knew everything. So which one is it, dude? And then he's just on Columbus Sports Radio having a hard time explaining, which you would have a hard time explaining had you physically abused your wife, how she got the bruises and how she got the cuts. So, I mean, like I was telling Willie, like we saw Gone Girl, but that was a movie. I have a hard time believing that Courtney Smith or really there's many women would actually do the things that happened in that movie. So I tend to believe her and question what in the world is wrong with her family. And I already know what's wrong with Ohio State fan base is at least that percentage that are loud and vocal about this. But it's interesting how this has gone this way.
Well, you have so many fans in a passionate fan base that want to believe that Urban Meyer did all the right things and he will be exonerated. It also sheds light on how hard it is to come out and say you were a victim. You have to endure all of this backlash. Even if she, let's just say, let's assume, just like all of us, that she's not perfect. Can you keep the focus on, if you're that committee, what actually happened? What can you document that she went through? Because while there were two calling of the police reports, like one at Ohio State in 2015 and one at Florida in 2009, there is no arrest, right? If you're just looking at the arrests and all that stuff, so you have to really delve into her story. But there's so much. What does she really have to gain by doing this?
I don't know.
Right?
Not
she's,
much.
She's going through a lot and enduring a lot to come out with what she hopes is just getting the truth out there.
And this isn't the first time, obviously, and it won't be the last time that a fan base or family, you know, discredits someone who is, claims to be a victim of this kind of stuff. We've seen it with Ohio State with the Zeke Elliott thing, back when back in Charlotte when Greg Hardy had his issue with that one woman. Big said, "Oh well, she's kind of a bad person because she was like on cocaine that night." Well, that doesn't stop her from getting thrown on a bed of guns and being beaten up. Like, that doesn't mean, because she might have been on cocaine, does not mean that she wasn't a victim of domestic violence that night. So it seems like they always find a way to, you know, twist it and make the victim look like a terrible person,
well,
to kind of discredit
the group at
Baylor what happens
that wanted Art Briles to remain as the coach.
Yeah, I mean,
and
even more stuff came out again last week about Baylor, which is just. I mean, why can we just shut that down?
Remember, there were people that were, I mean, vehemently saying, "You know, you can't get rid of Art Briles. What? We're actually good again." I mean, that's why. I mean, it's not just the coaches that get all this power that makes this thing way out of whack. It's honestly the fans too that get some that get just way out of whack and just. They lose sense of reality, just like these coaches. They're just, all they care about is the program being good or wins, and you just forget about the big picture. I mean, come on. That happened to Baylor. There were people who were like, "No, we're actually winning again. No, you can't get rid of him. I want to go back to the old days." You just shake your head. All right, we'll come back. Tim Hasselbeck to kick off the second hour of Darren and Donick. That's next.